From New Mexico to Virginia, Oklahoma to North Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Heritage Foundation has released its inaugural Education Freedom Scorecard. Lindsay Burke is here with details. The latest inflation numbers have been released, and they remain at a 40-year high, eating further into the buying power of American families. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Trillions of dollars were printed and borrowed supposedly to help the nation through the COVID-19 pandemic, but much of the money was spent on non-COVID projects. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jonathan Bidlack of the R Street Institute. And the flat tax revolution is gaining steam, with Idaho being the latest state to hop on board. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council talks about it on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, parents and taxpayers are paying more attention to education and demanding more choices. The Heritage Foundation has developed an Education Freedom Scorecard, and Lindsay Burke is here to discuss it. She is director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Lindsay, welcome to American Radio Journal. Lindsay, what is the Education Freedom Scorecard? This is the first one done by the Heritage Foundation, so tell us what it's all about.
This is our inaugural report card, and it's something that we plan to do annually from here on out, but it is exactly what it sounds like. We measure education freedom in the states, and that's what makes this unique among every other index or report card that's out there. Is we are really determining how free families are to not only select into learning environments that reflect their values and their hopes and their aspirations for their children, but also how free are they to see the content that is taught in their children's public schools? How free are you as a taxpayer to really know how well your taxpayer dollars are being spent when it comes to supporting education in your state? How free are you from regulatory red tape in your state? So this report card is unique in that regard, and that we're looking at things that have not been measured in a really comprehensive manner.
Let's break down each of those four areas a little further. Let's start with school choice. School choice, an important component of education freedom?
Incredibly important. And in fact, we weighted education choice heavier than the other components. So this overarching metric of education choice comprises 40% of the formula in our report card. And we assess things like private school choice. Do you have a voucher, tax credit, scholarship, or education savings account option in your state? We look at regulatory freedom for charter schools. How free are charter schools to open and operate? We look at homeschooling. How free are you as a family to be able to homeschool? We use the Homeschool Legal Defense Association's ranking of state homeschool laws. And we look at public school choice. Do you have choice within and between your public schools and public school districts in your state? So that's the education choice measure.
Of course, transparency is something that has really risen on the scale of importance for many parents, particularly through the COVID-19 pandemic. Transparency also a measure here?
Yeah, a big measure for us. This is 20% of our overall report card transparency. We look at how strong are your anti-critical race theory laws? Do you have protections for students and for teachers against things like compelled speech? What about parental empowerment? How many parent organizations do you have on the ground in your state? So there's a way for civil society to actually improve a state's ranking on our report card. And then in terms of accountability, when we think about accountability, we think about how accountable public schools and private schools are to parents. That's what really matters. So do parents have access to curriculum? Is it easy for a parent to see the types of curricular materials and textbooks and teacher trainings that schools are using?
What role does regulation play in all of this, Lindsay?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, the regulatory environment in this state is so important for hedging against, keeping those regs low, for hedging against red tape on both public and private schools. And so we did measure your overall regulatory environment. And some of the big components there that we looked at were, do you as a state have low barriers to entering the teaching profession. We want high-quality mid-career professionals to be able to enter the teaching profession if they want without a lot of barriers to entry. So do you as a state have alternative teacher certification options in place? Do you have reciprocity of your teacher licensure with other states? In other words, if you're licensed to teach in Florida, are you automatically licensed to teach in, say, Minnesota? The reciprocity of teacher licensure. So these are measures of whether or not an individual has to go through a college of education, which we know are, broadly speaking, captured by the left, or are there other ways for them to enter the teaching profession? We also looked at things like the number of diversity, equity, and inclusion staff, which in the K-12 realm are known as chief diversity officers. But what percentage of your school districts in your state employ a chief diversity officer? Because what we know is that the presence of these CDOs is not leading to academic excellence. They are not narrowing achievement gaps. They are really there to make teachers adhere to a political orthodoxy. And so you get dinged on our report card if you have a high number of CDOs in your school districts. And then finally, for regulatory environment, we looked at whether or not, as a state, you're still hanging on to old Common Core assessments.
And, of course, a very important factor is spending.
Spending, huge. So we look at return on investment for taxpayer dollars. And this is absolutely unique among everything else that's out there ranking state education policies. Often, if you look at other report cards, what you see is they measure how much a school spends. They measure inputs. They do not measure how far those dollars are going and how they relate to academic outcomes. And that's what we do in this report card. We look at cost of living adjusted spending per pupil. We look at, we say NAEP per dollar. So how much does it cost a state to improve a point on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which of course assesses reading and math achievement. And then we look at things like teacher and staff costs. So what is your teacher to non-teacher staff ratio? Are you as a state underwater on that measure, meaning do you employ more non-teaching staff than teachers in your school district? And then we look at unfunded teacher pension liabilities as a proportion of your state's gross domestic product. So a lot of measures in there assessing return on investment.
This being a scorecard, let's talk about who scored the best. What states came out on top?
Well, I'll give you the top five. So the number one state this year in our inaugural 2022 Education Freedom Report Card was Florida, which may not come as much of a surprise, but they were followed very closely by Arizona. Arizona, of course, just enacted the nation's first completely universal education savings account option. And then that was followed by Idaho, Indiana, and South Dakota. Those states did well on things like transparency and good return on investment. Now, at the bottom of the pack were states you may or may not expect. Massachusetts came in fifth from last on our report card. They are a high-spending state that provides very few options for families. But Massachusetts was followed by Maryland, New Jersey, New York, and Washington, D.C. So perhaps no huge surprises there.
One thing that sort of surprised me in looking at the ranking, the state of California, which I initially would have assumed, and of course you should never assume things, would have been in that bottom four or five, came in about the middle of the pack. What was it about California that gave it not as bad a showing as what you may expect?
Yeah, and I'm with you on that. They did a little better than anticipated. Overall, California came in 29th on our report card, and they were really pulled up because of their academic transparency. So they did pretty well on being pretty forthcoming with families about the content that is being taught in schools and just transparency measures broadly. But they perform poorly, of course, on things like school choice, regulatory freedom, and spending.
We have been talking with Dr. Lindsay Burke. She is director of the Center for Education Policy, that at the Heritage Foundation. We've been talking about their inaugural Education Freedom Scorecard. Lindsay, tell us a bit about Heritage. Where can folks go if they want to check out the Education Freedom Scorecards and see how their state did?
Well, of course, the Heritage Foundation is a broad-based think tank. We do far more than education policy, although it is one of our number one focuses right now. And within Heritage, you'll find our Center for Education Policy, where our team is. And if you want to delve into all of the data and check out our scorecard, you can find it at heritage.org/education-report-card.
Lindsay Burke of the Heritage Foundation. Lindsay, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's been parsing through all the economic numbers from the past week, especially inflation. We're going to talk about that. Scott, good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks.
Inflation, Scott, once again, is running at a 40-year high. It tanked the stock markets this past week. What impact do you see this having on the overall economic recovery that's supposed to be underway and the political scene going forward?
Obviously, the Biden White House is trying to spin this data, and they even went out there and held a little bit of a victory lap on the South Lawn and the side-by-side on CNN and Fox and CNBC and everybody else that's been covering the developments within the stock market showed a completely different reality compared to this celebration and an event that the Biden administration was holding. What we had this week was a 1,200-point drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, one of the biggest market indicators of the direction of our economy. That was the biggest one-day drop that we've had since June 2020, when we were really right on the cusp of the coronavirus pandemic. And so, obviously, with inflation at 8.3%, still around a 40-year high, a lot of folks want to transition the 2022 election towards something that's not the economy. But I think what we learned this week is that the health of the economy is certainly going to be on the minds of the American voter. Despite what Joe Biden is doing on the South Lawn of the White House, folks are learning this week that food is up 11.4% year over year in inflation. It was a 0.8% increase this month. So that's obviously a big, big pinch on the American wallet. And when you think about really what this level of inflation means to the average American, imagine if somebody told you that we're going to take away 1/12 of your paycheck, because basically that's what inflation is doing. It's taking away that much earning power for every income earner. And then when you take on the additional tax burden that people have, think about how much they're working for free because of this salacious appetite for big spending and big taxes from the Biden administration. So I hope that candidates throughout the country and listeners that are tuning in today will start to really hone in on this economic data and what it means for them. Because, you know, obviously when we go to the grocery store and you think about how full that cart gets before you reach your limit, or if you just are surprised by the sticker shock of the price of various meats and bacon and milk, that's going to begin to turn into a real kitchen table conversation in terms of the policies that led us there, the supply chain crisis. Energy prices are still very, very high comparatively to where they were when President Biden took office. And, you know, I hope that the American people look at their pocketbook and say, hey, you know, the economy is actually in pretty good shape. We were on the right direction headed into the pandemic. There were some things that were out of our control, but obviously the repeated blunders by big spending Democrats here in Washington has been a big mistake. And I think that's what's really adding fuel to the fire of our economic situation.
And we have the Federal Reserve slated to meet here again in a week or so, Scott, and actually talk now about perhaps a full point increase, a 100 basis point increase in interest rates. So that is going to also have an impact, right, on people who want to buy a house, a car, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, interest rates are a big part of the way that people can, number one, obtain a mortgage, and number two, how they go about financing that. And, you know, the average interest rate on homes was roughly 2.8%, 2.9% when Biden took office. Now it's in, you know, about 5.6%. It's almost doubled. And so that does have a major impact on home purchasing. And I think that there's a lot of folks right now that want to sell to take advantage of their asset, which is a home, the equity that they've got in that. But it's not really much of a seller's market right now because buyers are having this concern over interest rates. So we'll see exactly how the Fed proceeds. But obviously, they've already increased interest rates several times this year. It hasn't done much of an effect on inflation. And I'm obviously very, very concerned about the health of the economy right now. I think that we are very, very sick, despite what Anthony Fauci wants to tell you.
Let's switch now to politics. We're finally at the end of the primary election season. Of course, the general election cycle has begun in every state across the country now. The last primary in New Hampshire, we have a nominee for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, this was the last significant primary of the election season, the primary election season. In the New Hampshire Senate race, Don Bolduc beat Chuck Morse by exactly 1,800 votes. Almost all the votes have been counted. And Morse has conceded that election to Bolduc. This is one of those situations where Mitch McConnell and the Senate Leadership Fund poured millions and millions of dollars behind Chuck Morse in an attempt to stop Bolduc from being the Republican nominee. But if we've learned anything, it's that the establishment does not represent the will of the primary voter in many states. And so Bolduc pulled out that victory, and he will face Senator Hassan in the general election. Obviously, this is a short runway for one of the more competitive races in America. I would put New Hampshire right along the mix of states like Arizona, Georgia, and Nevada. We'll see if Bolduc can pull it out. He's traditionally kind of struggled with raising money to be competitive, but he does have a pretty significant grassroots following among sort of the MAGA base.
We, of course, are going to be keeping an eye on all of these key United States Senate races. We're going to be talking a lot more about that over the next couple of weeks with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We've got over 525,000 members from all 50 states. So if anybody wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Okay, thank you.
Were those trillions of federal dollars sent to states and municipalities to weather the COVID-19 pandemic necessary? To find out, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jonathan Bidlack from the R Street Institute.
From big bonuses for government employees to spending on things like golf courses and baseball stadiums, lots of the money that was distributed during the pandemic to state and local governments was misspent or just went to things that had nothing to do with the pandemic at all. But identifying that that happened and identifying why that happened are two kind of different things. And we're going to take a look at the second one of those issues today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Jonathan Bidlack. He is the director of the governance program at the R Street Institute. And previous to that, he was the founder and president of the Institute for Spending Reform and the Coalition to Reduce Spending. Hey, Jonathan, I think we should reduce spending on lots of things. So we're getting off on the right foot here. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much. I think we're in agreement on that point.
Yeah, I think so. We'll see if we can find some disagreement here. But this is something that you've been following for a while, is the large amounts of money that were spent by the federal government via states and local governments in many cases, but ultimately federal spending during the pandemic in a couple of different waves. And before we get into some of the deeper stuff we want to talk about here, just give us some examples of like the ways in which that money has been misused. I know there have been many. What like has really caught your eye?
One of the great examples, and this goes back, I think, to the CARES Act, actually, was there was a county in California, I think Santa Clara County, that basically gave hero pay to every public employee. They basically just took this money and said, you're all heroes, and we're going to give you all, I think it was, you know, $2,500 bonuses, which was, of course, not really the purpose of funding that was being extended to states and localities. And you had other cases of fraud. I think there was an audit at one point where Kim Reynolds, the governor of Iowa, was using COVID funds for salaries. So there's all these kinds of really egregious things. And I think it brings us to this point, which is that when you literally have trillions of dollars being sent out the door from Washington, it's pretty much impossible to have adequate oversight. And when you think about, you know, just some of these extreme examples, there are probably 5 to 10 other examples that people haven't figured out, that for every one that we do know about.
How much of the problem, Jonathan, was just that the federal government shoveled out money in such large volumes to states and localities that, like, in many cases, didn't really need it and didn't know what to do with it?
I think a lot of it depends on what stage of the pandemic we were in. I mean, early on, when this first started happening, there was a lot of uncertainty. And there was this attitude, I think, that was, you know, where there was frankly agreement from both sides that, you know, there's a role for the federal government and we need to push this money out immediately because we don't really know what ultimately is going to happen. over time, we started to learn a lot more. So, for example, in the early stages, there was fear that the state budgets or local budgets were going to be in really bad shape. But later on, we learned that, well, actually, home prices are going through the roof. Property tax revenue is going up. Most state budgets were actually doing quite well. And yet we still had many in Washington, in this case, you know, on the left side of the aisle, but there are examples on the right as well, where it was sort of like, well, let's continue to push this funding out to states and localities, even though at that point we knew that they didn't really need it. So this is a big part of the problem, right? Incentives are not always aligned in the way that we need them to be. And policymakers don't, again, face the same incentives as private sector actors.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. You know, there was that concern early in the pandemic that this was going to crush state budgets, and then we ended up seeing a lot of states run surpluses during the pandemic, but Congress threw a lot of money at them anyway. We're talking with Jonathan Bidlack. He is the director of the governance program at the R Street Institute, and we're talking about some of the ways that money was misspent during the pandemic. And I think really kind of deeper than that, that the incentives, you just talked about this, Jonathan, the incentives at play for the way policymakers distributed this money and then other policymakers used it or misused it is something that's important. And one thing that worries me about all this is that we had a bunch of different waves of big pandemic era spending programs, right? There was the CARES Act originally that was in the spring of 2020, right after the pandemic had hit. There were a couple smaller stimulus bills after that. And then there was another real big one, the American Rescue Plan, in the early days of the Biden administration. So you had like two different administrations, a different makeup of Congress in, you know, in passing these bills. And yet, we ended up in both cases with the solution being, or the quote unquote solution being, throwing tons of money at the problem. Maybe it's unfair for me to be lumping those two bills together because, as you said earlier, very different circumstances. But this was a bipartisan response.
I think that's right. And I think when you take Econ 101 in college, it's not like there's the page of the textbook that tells you this is what you should do when a pandemic hits. And so I think that policymakers basically looked back to the last time there was a perceived economic emergency, which was 2007 and 2008. And they said, what did we do then? Well, we threw a whole bunch of money at the problem. We kind of gave it to everyone in a sense. And so the playbook in the pandemic in 2020 and 2021 and going into this year was quite similar. And so that's I think the first point is that most policymakers are not economic experts. They don't really know what to do in these kinds of situations. Many economists didn't really know what to do in this situation. And so they looked at the last experience that looked somewhat similar, and they decided to do that same thing. The other point I'll make here, and this is to build off of something you said earlier, is that it wasn't the same when, you know, the American Rescue Plan was enacted. We knew, people were writing at the time, that we essentially had an output gap of $400 billion, and then here we are going and throwing five times that or more at the problem. And so the response at that point in time was not really proportional to what it should have been based on what we knew at the time. And that, I think, is the part that's perhaps the most unforgivable about this most recent effort.
I would love to ask you if you think they're going to get it right next time, but unfortunately we are out of time. I have my doubts. I suspect you do as well. That is Jonathan Bidlack. He is the director of the governance program at the R Street Institute. John, thanks for joining us here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And again, you can check out the R Street Institute's work at rstreet.org. They do a lot of fine analysis on a wide range of topics. Again, that's rstreet.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
A state flat tax is one way to give some relief to consumers suffering from the nation's record high inflation rate. So says Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
As we have all seen and felt, year-over-year inflation for the month of August was above 8% yet again, at a whopping 8.3%. In response to the inflation numbers and the likely to come Federal Reserve interest rate hikes, the stock market just tumbled to its worst single day since June of 2020, as the Dow Jones Index plummeted over 1,200 points. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden and progressives were unbelievably hosting a celebration at the White House to mark the one-month anniversary of the signing of the ironically and misnamed Inflation Reduction Act. Talk about tone deaf. The reality is that while taxpayers are paying more at the pump and the grocery store and seeing major hits to their 401ks and IRAs, the Inflation Reduction Act is simply more wasteful government spending that will only serve to fuel more inflation, let alone hire 87,000 new IRS agents to audit law-abiding American citizens. While the Inflation Reduction Act does anything but what the name suggests, Congress should look to the 50 laboratories of democracy for real solutions. The states, once again, are leading the charge in implementing free market policy solutions, positioning those states for real economic growth. The latest example of this is in Idaho. Just on September 1st, Idaho became the latest state to switch from a progressive personal income tax to a flat tax. This makes Idaho the fifth state to join the flat tax revolution so far in 2022, the second time in this year that Idaho has taken on tax reform. In February, the Idaho legislature passed and Governor Brad Little signed HB 436, which lowered the top personal income tax in Idaho to 6 from 6.5% and reduced the number of brackets from 5 to 4. But thankfully, the gem state wasn't finished. Just last week, the Idaho legislature convened for a one-day special session and used a $2 billion budget surplus to give $500 million back to taxpayers through a tax rebate and provide a $150 million tax cut. Idaho's four personal income tax brackets were consolidated into a flat rate of 5.8%, which goes into effect in January of 2023. Currently, Idaho's top marginal income tax rate is 6%. Also, Idaho was wise to cut business income taxes. The tax on business income will now be 5.8%, down from 6%. Business income taxes are counterproductive to state economic growth. That's because businesses, at the end of the day, don't pay taxes. People pay taxes, whether it's through cost passed on to consumers, fewer jobs created, or lower wages for employees. If job creators leave states like California, Illinois, and New York, they will now have more reasons to look to Idaho as a potential new home. Clearly, Idaho lawmakers and Governor Little understand that standing still on economic policies can lead to a decline in economic competitiveness, and you can really fall behind just by standing still. Idaho already boasts the ranking of fifth best for economic outlook in the 2022 edition of Rich States, Poor States, the Alec Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index. These new changes are likely to boost the gem state's ranking even further. Idaho's success in implementing this tax reform, which is a sign that free market principles of taxation are really alive and well, and should be a call to action for other free market states to examine their own tax systems. While the Idaho tax cuts, as well as those, importantly, earlier this year in Iowa, Mississippi, Georgia, and Arizona, and more, were made possible by budget surpluses, these states have also gone a long way to really protect fiscal responsibility through their budgeting practices. And these states, unlike the federal government, have done well to spend within their means, allowing spending to chase tax dollars rather than tax dollars chasing spending. And they prioritize the opportunity to return those tax dollars to their hardworking taxpayers. Congress can and should learn a lot from the good stewards of fiscal responsibility in the states. The flat tax revolution is alive and well, and we expect many more states to consider these important reforms in the future. For more information, visit alec.org and richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WVTJ-AM in Pensacola, Florida, WCPC-AM in Tupelo, Mississippi, along with WITK-AM in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.